Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. It's the middle of summer, and the thoughts of our nation's youth are focused on fun in the sun or trying to get through a part-time job flipping hamburgers at the local Dairy Queen. But oh, how short the summer is. Pretty soon, it is back to school. For a significant portion of our country's younger population, this means heading to college for a bit of higher education. Or for those juniors and seniors in high school, thoughts will quickly turn to which university to apply to and what would be the best way to get accepted to one's top choice. There are many options out there, from the large, well-known secular research universities such as UCLA to smaller religiously-based institutions such as Union University. Of course, there is everything in between as well, including small secular liberal arts colleges and larger religiously-based research universities such as Baylor, the proud sponsor of our podcast. On today's program, I would like to take a look at the state of religiously-based higher education in both its microcosm, namely how a small faith-based university recruits and trains its students, and at a more macro-level scale, asking the questions of how a religious school can retain its spiritual mission in an academic world where secularism seems to flourish. To discuss all of this, I am joined by Dr. Joseph Castleberry, the president of Northwest University, a religiously-based school located in the suburban outskirts of Seattle, Washington. Dr. Castleberry, a native of Alabama who has spent time traveling the world, including time as a missionary and college professor in El Salvador, received his doctorate in education from Columbia University and is author of two recent books, The Kingdom Net, Learning to Network Like Jesus, due out in just a few weeks, and Your Deepest Dream. He also blogs regularly in English and Spanish at www.josephcastleberry.com and www.inmigrantesdedios.org. We will link to all of these books and websites, as well as the homepage of Northwest University at our website for your further inspection. Joseph, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
It feels a little weird calling you Joseph, given that you are a university president and all. But I've had some pretty big names on the guest on the show, and I've always called them by your first name. So, Joseph, okay?
How about Joe? That'll work.
Joe, that works even better. So, all right. Very good, Joe. What I want to do today is to explore your background a bit and learn how one becomes a university president. And I'm doing that just in the event that I need to look for another job because this podcasting, it's not paying too well now. So, but before that, I think it's important to set the context of this interview in terms of Northwest University. I don't think many of our listeners know of your institution. So tell us a little bit about its history and composition. We're sipping from teacups, actually, in fact, here that said building on 75 years, Northwest University.
Well, yes, we were started in 1934 in Seattle as a Bible institute. Our founders were humble people. There were very few of them who had college degrees, but they had an incredible vision. They planned to start as a Bible institute and over the years grow into a full-service college that would offer majors in various fields and at all levels, all the way through the doctoral level. Really, back in 1934, they envisioned what we've become today, 79 years later. We've had a wonderful history, growing from a small Bible institute to an accredited Bible college to a liberal arts college and now to a comprehensive university. We've really followed the same sort of upward mobility track that you see in the state normal schools. Normal schools tended to be founded as small private institutions with single focus. Over time, they were taken over by the state. The state turned them into state teachers' colleges. Then later, they became state colleges, and then later state universities, usually with some regional moniker on it, like say, Western Washington University or Eastern Washington University. We follow the same mobility track, and we're pretty much as diverse as most of those regional state universities in terms of our course offerings.
Now, are you thinking being taken over by Washington State anytime soon?
Oh, no. That only happens to you when you can't hold your finances together, and we're pretty stable in that way.
Sounds good. Now, you started as a Bible Institute way back when, 75 or so years ago. A lot of these Bible colleges start with some type of denominational affiliation, and Northwest University is a pretty generic title. You're a university in the Northwest. Any denomination? Affiliation?
Yes, I always say we're a post-denominational university affiliated with the Assemblies of God.
Okay, what does that mean?
It's a self-contradictory statement in some ways, but it means that our sponsoring church, the Assemblies of God, has commissioned us to be their best gift to the rest of the body of Christ. And so they expect us to train people from all kinds of different Christian backgrounds. And about 28% of our students come from Assemblies of God churches now, and the rest from a wide spectrum of churches across Christianity.
The other thing that's interesting to note, too, is that recently you went from being a college now to a university. And I think in the vernacular, a lot of people talk about, oh, my son's going off to college when they're going to a university. And then they hear terms like there's colleges within universities, and that can become rather confusing. So what is the difference between a college and a university? And also tell us a little bit about why and how Northwest made that switch.
Well, traditionally, a college is an institution of education that is governed by one academic dean. It tends to have only undergraduate programs, whereas a university is organized, rather than being organized in departments that are run by department heads under one dean, it's organized into different colleges and schools that are governed by a dean, and then who reports to a provost above as the chief academic officer. So it's a different way of organizing the school that gives each of the different programs a little more autonomy and a little more specific direction from inside their discipline. Mm-hmm. And of course, graduate programs come with that. So there's been a move in the last 20 years for pretty much across the board for colleges to begin to call themselves university and change their administrative model to fit the new name, because college is a word that has begun to be associated in America with sort of vocational training of secretarial colleges, barber colleges, Bible colleges, and the name doesn't carry as much prestige as it did in the 1900s and 1800s.
Mm-hmm. And you changed, not you personally, because I think you came after this change, but Northwest changed about 10 years ago to a college?
In 2005.
2005. So yeah, about 8 years ago or so. How did that process occur? Did it get to a point where we finally said, whoa, we're very large here, so we can, you know, much like an amoeba, split into different units now and be headed by a president and several deans?
I think at Northwest, changing the name to Northwest University and changing the administrative structure to match that was essentially a magnet to our future. The name drug us into a more complex future than we had experienced in the past. So definitely the change of name here inspired the university to be more aggressive in starting new programs and getting secondary accreditations for its different professional programs and that kind of thing. So changing the name to university was a great strategy for Northwest that's improved us a great deal. It's been an exciting 8 years. I've been here for six of those years, and we've seen the school grow in enrollment every single year. We're running about 14 straight years of record enrollments now. So the different colleges and schools have been a good move for us.
And roughly, what is your enrollment now, undergraduate and graduate?
Well, we were 1,612 this year. Next year, we're expecting to be over 1,900.
Oh, so that's a 300 increase in students. And how's that broken down between undergraduate and graduate students?
Traditional undergraduates on campus are about 950, and the rest would be at our extension sites in Salem, Oregon. We'll be opening a brand new brand new campus in Sacramento, California with about 100 students in the fall. We will have probably 270 graduate students, perhaps 300 adult ed students who are in degree completion style programs, and a good number of online students, a couple hundred online students as well.
Yeah, the online education movement is moving and shaking now. I actually myself am doing a number of online classes, and that is an interesting model that is still taking shape. I'm fascinated to find out that you have campuses, extensions in Salem, Oregon, you said, and somewhere down in California?
Sacramento.
Sacramento, California. How does that operate? Are there physical brick and mortar places down there, or is that done through an online environment?
Well, if it has physical bricks and mortars, brick and mortar, we call it a campus. If it's a place that we say rent from another institution or rented space that we don't own, then we call it an extension usually. So the two campuses, Sacramento and Salem, are actually brick and mortar operations.
Wow. Very interesting. And what was the rationale behind expanding to Salem and Sacramento? And any reason to pick those other than it also had an S in its name? You know, you have Seattle, Sacramento, and Salem. But
I can safely say that had no part of the consideration.
All right. But what was the reason for expanding? Is there just an interest in students couldn't make it up to the campus that you have here in Kirkland, Washington, but there's still a demand for what you're offering, and you just go down there?
Well, my background has been in the world of foreign missions and in distance education. I was in distance education back in the old days before online education was available, and so I have a strong belief in the efficacy of distance education. And in getting the education close to where it's needed, there are trade-offs that you make when you do it that way. But I think that the research is pretty strong to demonstrate that distance education works. In the context of training ministers, that continues to be a very important part of what we do. Of our total student body, about 300 people are studying for Christian ministry. More and more in our society, ministry training needs to be close to the ground. It needs to be close to where the service is needed. And by opening extensions in Nampa, Idaho, we've got one there as well, and campuses in Salem and Sacramento, and at sites across the state of Washington, seven other sites, we're getting the training closer to the local churches and to where people live, and allowing them to get training in a way that works with their whole life.
And are most of these extension programs aimed at theological training, or do you offer other? We should probably talk a little bit about the other things that Northwest offers. You're not just training ministers, but you're training students to be well-rounded students. So they have biology classes, they have political science classes, you name it, it's here at the university. But are these extensions primarily aimed at training ministers?
They tend to be aimed at professional training. We believe strongly in the liberal arts, and all degree programs will always have a strong liberal arts component to them. And they have since we were founded in the 1930s. Even back then, they believed that ministers should have a strong liberal arts background. So we've always believed in that. But most of our online programs are more career oriented. So one of those areas is ministry, but another one is criminal justice. We just rolled out a new program in criminal justice this summer, and is getting off to a quick start, so that's been exciting. We have another program in teaching English as a second language, a master's degree program, and our MBA program will be available online starting this month.
Wow. Okay, very exciting. The criminal justice program sounds very interesting. I know a number of Christian organizations are getting involved in prison ministry as well as other aspects of the criminal justice system. We've had Byron Johnson talking on our show about that, and we'll link to that. So really neat that you're doing that. So criminal justice, you offer an MBA program, you offer ministry programs. What other types of programs are you offering at Northwest?
Oh, at Northwest, a pretty wide variety, about 60 undergraduate majors and a dozen graduate programs here on the main campus.
Okay. Covering just basically the wide swath of what you'd expect at any other university.
We sort of do everything but engineering.
Okay. No engineering.
Yeah.
All right.
No engineering programs. We don't have a computer science program, but the liberal arts fields and then several professional fields, including nursing. Our nursing school is extremely fine. Business, education, again, ministry, counseling. So A lot of professional programs in addition to the classic liberal arts majors.
Yeah, excellent. I know of several students in your nursing program. They speak very highly of it. You should get an engineering program, though, because when I have visited your campus several times, they always seem to be working on the roads right in front of campus. It's always hard to get in. So maybe you can just go out there and ask those guys and set up an engineering major for you folks. What about the student body? You mentioned that you are roughly around 1,200 or so students are increasing to by 300, so it's a lot depending how you count the numbers in the different extension campuses. But what about the composition of the student body? Are they pulling primarily from, especially talking about your central campus here in Kirkland, Washington, are they primarily pulling from Washington? Are they from around the Pacific Northwest, the United States, globally? What's the mix here?
We draw 80% of our students from the state of Washington. We draw from 24 states typically, and typically 25 foreign countries, although that's always moving. It's always different ones. We have a natural entree into the foreign market through our association with the Assemblies of God, and so it's not hard to get foreign students for us.
That's what I wanted to ask. I've always wondered that Northwest University, and I will admit here, I've lived in the Seattle region for about 20 years, and this university only came to my attention in about 2005, 2006. I always wondered, well, if I'm just 10 miles down the road, and I don't know where you are, how does somebody in Nigeria or China find out about this? Is it largely through the Assemblies of God ministry programs that they find out?
That's a big part of it. I think people probably have, just like they don't know Northwest is here, or don't know how complex our operation is, or how many students are here, I think people don't realize how large the Assemblies of God is. It's probably the fourth or fifth largest organization in all of Christianity. We have 65 million members around the world in literally every political nation in the world. We have a natural network of missionaries and national church leaders, alumni all over the world who tell our story and attract a certain number of students to us every year.
Yeah, I can imagine. I've talked to a number of your undergraduate students and asked them, well, you know, after graduation, what you're doing. And a lot of them say, well, I'm going to spend a year doing missions and, you know, sort things out professionally, but they feel a calling for mission. And I can imagine that's a natural conduit. They go off to another country and they say, hey, where are you from? And they say, oh, Northwest University. And they say, oh, you know, you're a really good person. Tell us more about that. I would assume that's a big conduit.
Yeah, the religious movement that founded Northwest, and it still is our heartbeat, the Pentecostal movement, is by nature a global movement. Our people see themselves as global citizens, and they're deeply concerned about getting their message to the whole world. So since 1934, we've been sending out missionaries all over the world, and so we have a huge, huge network of friends around the world.
So that brings me to you. How did you end up in Kirkland, Washington here at Northwest University? You don't have a traditional route through the academy, but you took an interesting circuitous path via missions in El Salvador. So give us a brief history of Joseph Castleberry up until your landing here at Northwest University in Kirkland.
Yeah, there are a lot of paths that will lead you to a university presidency. And, you know, one of my heroes out there in the university president world was Jim Laney, who was the president of Emory University from 1977 to 1993. Those were the years in which Emory made the huge leap from a small liberal arts college in the South to a major national secular university. And it was led by Jim Laney, who was a missionary to Korea in his early years. And after his time at Emory, was named ambassador to South Korea. So, you know, it's not that unusual in the history of American academia for missionaries to become college presidents. But there are lots of ways you get to a college presidency. And it tends to, one of the ways you get there is by having a strong academic background along with a strong record of leadership and participation in other things. So in my case, I've always had one foot in the academy and one foot in the church. I felt a sense of divine leading to be a college president at age 21. And so I've always known this is what I was headed towards. But I also felt called to be a foreign missionary and to be a scholar, and a pastor. When I was 12 years old, I went in the kitchen and told my mother that when I grew up, I wanted to pastor intellectual people. And she just kind of looked at me strange and said, no, that'd be That'd be good.
Your mom said you're 12 years old. Most 12-year-olds might be firefighters or be an astronaut on the moon or something. But okay, that's good.
This was about like trying to be an astronaut on the moon. I came from a family that had never been to college. Nobody in our church had gone to college. That was a sort of a strange idea. But I knew I was a student, and I knew I had a call from God on my life. So by the time I got to college, I wanted to be a pastor and a Bible scholar and a missionary, and before I ended college, knew that I never wanted to leave the college world. So my first job in the ministry was as the Assemblies of God chaplain at Princeton University. So that was my very first full-time job in the ministry, and it was exactly what I'd wanted to do when I was 12.
And that's Presbyterian territory. How did that work out, being an Assemblies of God minister or chaplain's aide or chaplain, I guess, at Presbyterian Central?
Well, it was a great experience for me. And, of course, Princeton University is an amazing institution, extremely diverse and open to lots of perspective. It's not a Presbyterian school. It's a fully secularized school.
Yes, but it has that.
But it does have a strong Presbyterian background. It was a phenomenal experience working with some of the brightest people in the world and really one of the great academic centers in the world. So it was exciting for me. I did my Master of Divinity degree at Princeton Theological Seminary, which was unusual for a Pentecostal like me. From there, I went to El Salvador and taught in the first Assemblies of God University in the world in San Salvador. So I was a university professor there and started a church to reach out to intellectuals of the National University. And so we had a successful church plant there for a while that reached out to intellectuals in the country. And I had a Bible study for poets in Spanish, which if you've never led a Bible study for poets in your second language, you've never lived.
Yeah. As somebody who's done research in Latin America and has had to learn Spanish, I admit that my Spanish always gets rusty when I haven't been there. But poetry, that has all the subtleties of the language. So you have to know that inside and out.
It was a phenomenal education. I stayed active as a scholar, continued to work in university settings, then went on to Columbia University for my doctorate in international educational development, continued to publish some things, be involved in scholarly conferences. I became dean of a seminary in Ecuador. I'd never worked a day in an American college as a faculty member or administrator when I got the opportunity to go to our denominational seminary as academic dean in 2002.
And where was that?
In Springfield, Missouri, at the Assemblies of God Theological Seminary.
Okay.
And after 5 years of being academic dean there and sort of in the second chair, I started getting involved in searches for college presidencies, and Northwest opened up in 2007, and I came here, and it's been a terrific terrific journey. So my career led me through the academy, but not in the traditional sense that secular people would expect.
Okay, well, the Pacific Northwest is all the better for you being here. And so it was through your work as an academic dean at the Assemblies of God Theological School that you start to see these openings. So there wasn't an ad on a phone pole or a telephone pole or something that says, President needed, and it has those little tear things down, call 1-800-555, something like that.
That's sort of what my next book is about, The Kingdom Net, Learning to Network Like Jesus. It's about how networking makes the world go round, and especially in the Christian world. The relationships that you make, the people that you get to know, the publicity that you can have through your writings and through the work that you do, the speaking that you do, it gets you in front of the right people, and it all comes together. But that's the way most professional success happens.
It does. The doors are always opening. You just got to be ready to see that the door is opening and to, I guess, take that leap of faith to say, okay, that's what I'm going to do in the next step of my life. Was there any moment in time where you said, oh, I don't know if I should be doing this? I mean, I'm thinking going from Princeton, New Jersey down to San Salvador must have been did you ever stop and think, should I be doing this?
Oh, no. I've always had a really strong sense of direction and leading. It was a great experience. El Salvador was in the middle of the Civil War when we went there. It was we arrived in the country right after the killing of the Jesuit priests there, and it was pretty conflictive. We saw a lot of interesting things while we were there and faced some strange dangers. but no, we never had a sense, neither my wife nor I, that we were doing the wrong thing or weren't on the right path.
And that path, too, that takes you to El Salvador for a significant chunk of your professional life. Has that been beneficial to your career here now as a university president? If so, how? What things can you carry over from that?
I can't think of better formation for a university presidency than being a missionary. You get incredible opportunities to start things from scratch, to have an entrepreneurial event. You get to know people. You get to learn how to manage people. You get to learn about human difference and culture. And, and in my case, I mean, most missionaries in our world, in our Assemblies of God world, spend time teaching in schools and colleges to train up the next generation of ministers and that kind of thing. So, you get teaching experience, administrative experience, fundraising experience, networking experience. I built buildings. There was a little bit on small level of just about everything I do as a college president involved in just being a missionary. It depends on how aggressive and how industrious you are, but I work pretty hard. Most missionaries do. Mm-hmm. And it was great training.
No, I can imagine that. It gives you an outward looking perspective, I would imagine, too. And if a place like Northwest University really wants to grow and expand as it is right now, that vision, just that general mindset, can only be beneficial.
Yeah, it's been a great help.
Okay. Now, talking about expanding and doing your job, doing the administrative stuff, I want to focus on what it's like to operate a religiously based institution of higher education. And this will kind of focus mostly on your experience here at Northwest, but if you want to bring in other observations you've made from place in that where you were the dean and from some of your other colleagues around the United States, please feel free to bring those into the conversation. First off, let's start with that critical question of recruiting students. This is, missionary sense. You got to bring people in to fill up the pews so they can hear the message, right? So what do you do? What do you specifically do to attract students to Northwest University here in Kirkland, Washington?
Well, I don't want to disappoint you, but we do exactly what every university in the country does.
Oh, I thought it was going to be. See, and that's good to know, because there's people out there who says, well, that secular University of Washington world is so different than the Northwest University world, but there are similarities. We need to know. What do you do?
Well, it may manifest itself a little different, but the categories are the same.
Okay.
So where do we get students? We get students because we've got 9,000 alumni out there who have children and grandchildren and friends. A lot of, we've been training ministers forever here. So lots and lots, hundreds and hundreds of pastors of churches are alumni of our school. And of course, they like for the students in their church to consider coming here. So, the word of mouth that goes from alumni to their networks attracts students to us. We have campus days here on campus. We call it Northwest Friday, and students who are interested in us, have heard about us from their parents or their pastors or others, will come and visit the campus. They like what they see, or they don't, either way, and they come. We attend college fairs at high schools, both secular high schools and Christian schools and even homeschool associations.
Yeah, that's becoming a big thing now, too.
Well, it's growing seven times faster than the public school enrollment rate right now, homeschools are. So we do everything that every other college does to recruit, including, internet marketing, email campaigns. Our website, of course, is incredibly important. Yeah, everything that every other college in the country is doing, we do. The fact that we're not as highly selective as some schools changes the game a little bit. We're not having to we don't have to spend as much time and money vetting the students as a highly selective school would spend.
So in terms of the number of people that apply versus the number of people that accept and then eventually come to the school, what do you have a sense of that ratio at all?
We do pretty well. If we accept the students, we land a lot of them. Yeah. So, I don't have that number on top of my head, but I'd say probably 3/4 of the students we accept are wind up as students here.
Well, one of the questions I had, now you just mentioned that you cast the net fairly broad. You even go to secular high schools, you go to college fairs, homeschool co-ops. I was thinking that you would have specific target audiences that you would go to Christian high schools or something, but you do cast pretty broad.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Now, on the other hand, we only, and this is the difference, our standard of selectivity is high in the sense that we only accept Christian students. I always say that Harvard is prejudiced against ignorant dumb students. They won't have a single one come. You know,
right? Yeah.
They're really prejudiced against your average student, your C student. They just won't let them come at all.
They didn't let me in.
And their selectivity is based on, you know, SAT scores and class rank and leadership demonstration and all of that stuff. So they're very selective on criteria that they've chosen. Our criterion of selectivity is a sense of a student's calling from God to live a life of discipleship in Christ. So we only accept Christian students to our undergraduate traditional programs. Our online programs, graduate programs, adult programs are open to all comers. But, you know, the on-campus residential student here, that community is a very tight community of Christian discipleship that we protect. I mean, we're trying to accomplish a specific thing here, and it wouldn't be fair to non-believing students to come and expect them to live by the moral standards and strictures that we expect our students to live by.
And that raises me to the next question, and it was especially prompted when you raised the issue that, we go to secular high schools as well to recruit. Is this issue of secularization growing in the United States? Many people say it's happening. I'm a little bit dubious on that, but there's been survey evidence that shows the number of religious nuns, N-O-N-E-S, people without any denominational affiliation, has been growing. Do you find any difficulty in going out to what might be a more secular population to recruit people? Do they look at you saying, you're religious school, that's kind of strange. Why are you here at Garfield High School? We're a public school.
Well, the Gallup polls and everything show that about 40% of Americans claim to be born again.
Yeah, that's a big area.
The vast majority of Americans say that they believe in God. So why shouldn't we be there if 70% of the people that are there are potentially students for Northwest? We're not trying to be ugly about it. We're not mean to people, but we're very clear about who we are because we don't want people to come here and be disappointed. So from the get-go, we're very full-throated about who we are and what we do. And students that aren't interested in that, they run away from that pretty fast. And
yeah, you know,
a lot of college students don't want to come to a school that won't let you drink alcohol and expects you to behave yourself morally. They'd rather do something different at college. So
you still find that there's a pretty big audience out there for the services you're offering.
Oh, absolutely. And it's just from a purely marketing perspective, everybody's got a niche. And we've got a wonderful niche. I mean, who wouldn't want 40% of the American population is their niche?
Yeah.
In terms of here in the state of Washington, the most students who come to Northwest come from Pentecostal and Charismatic churches. And the Pew survey that came out a couple of years ago demonstrates that 10% of the population of Washington is Pentecostals and Charismatics. It's the highest of it. Here in the middle of the nun zone, right? We're here in the middle of the nun zone, 10% of the entire population attends Pentecostal and Charismatic churches. And the Assemblies of God is the largest Protestant denomination in Washington. We're thrilled to have that niche. That's a great niche.
And it's a growing niche as well, too. One of the things you'll see, even though there's supposedly a stagnation of Christian growth, the Pentecostal and Assemblies of God still are growing.
No, absolutely. And it's because of being full-throated about our faith. And we're not backing off that one inch. That's what we're here for.
Are you finding, when you go out to talk with students and parents, that there's a receptivity to the religious nature of your program, and with some parents saying, boy, I don't want to send my children to a secular university because I'm worried about what they have there. You are the folks that we are blessed to see out in our region. Are you picking up some of that?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I did a big piece of my doctoral dissertation had to do with the effects of college on the faith of students. What the research is demonstrating right now is that the young person, the teenager who is most likely to fall away from Christian faith during their 20s is the one who doesn't go to college at all.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah. You know,
I thought it had been going to a big secular state party school or something.
The most guaranteed way that your kid will walk away from Christian faith is if they don't go to college at all. Now, plenty of kids that don't go to college remain Christians, and that's great. But not going to college is very detrimental to your faith in general. Going to a secular university, about 70% of students, 65 to 70% of students who go to a secular university from Christian backgrounds will abandon the faith during their time in college. So that's a terrible number for if you're thinking about retention, you know, if that matters to you. And of course, it does matter to Christian parents. If you go to a college in the CCCU, that is the Consortium for Christian, the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, there are about 106 of those colleges in the country that are rigorously Christian. If you go to one of those schools, it's about 70% that keep their faith. And if you come to a school like Northwest that is only allows Christians in their student body, the chances of persisting in your faith are way higher. It's got to be above 90%. So coming to a Christian university can definitely help students to maintain their faith. On the other hand, there's a self-selecting feature there too. You know, students who choose to come to school like this are pretty serious about their faith to start with. So
it's easier to retain
them. So, yeah, we can't take all the credit for that. But, you know, that's a very important drawing card for parents. And, you know, students don't fall away because Christian faith is intellectually untenable. I mean, some of the most brilliant people in the world are Christians. Christian faith is not incompatible with great intellect. But there are a lot of other things that draw teenagers and young 20-somethings away from faith as well. There's lots of temptation out there,
yeah. You know. All the bells and whistles of the big city, the bright city lights and that, yeah.
And your peers are the biggest influence on you. It isn't that atheist professor in class that makes fun of Christians. I mean, some students that'll embarrass them, and others it makes them more fire-breathing in their faith, you know, to experience some opposition. But peers make a huge difference. And in a place like this, where your peers are pretty serious about following Christ, it helps you to do that yourself and not be drawn away into things that would challenge your faith in ways that go beyond the intellectual.
As you mentioned before, those networks are very important, and who's in that network is going to be very important. But it's also an issue of what you offer at the university. And I want to talk a little bit about what campus life is like here. Do most of your students reside on campus, or are you a commuter university?
Most of our students in the traditional undergraduate program reside on campus, yes.
Okay, so you have dormitories for them. And what kind of programs do you have? Are there mandatory chapel services?
Well, there are lots of different things that we do to ensure the spiritual formation of our students. One of them is that they have to take 18 credits in Bible and theology. Some of those credits are specially tailored to their major field. Others are more general, Bible courses or theology courses. We want them to have the ability to read the scriptures and to be able to think Christianly about their lives and about their careers. So integration of faith and learning is what that's usually called. So we have that 18-credit structure. And then, of course, all the courses at Northwest are going to consider issues of faith in them, some more than others, but all the courses are integrating faith and learning.
Now, do you have a chapel on campus that services students for their regular services, say on Sunday, or do you partner with local churches in the region? Do you have one that you tend to funnel students to more than others?
Well, we expect our students to go to church on Sunday, but you know, they come from so many different kinds of churches that we don't care where they go on Sunday. But we're not leaving it up to that. We have chapel services here on the campus several times a week. Currently, next year it will be three times a week that they'll be scheduled chapels on campus. Students are expected to go to two out of three of those. If they don't, they will go on chapel probation. And if they go second semester on chapel probation, they get a fine. If they go the third semester on chapel probation, they could be expelled, because chapel is required here. We're the only school in the state of Washington, I believe, that has mandatory chapel, but we take it very seriously, and our students. they enjoy it or they don't.
Okay, I was going to ask. You said they enjoy it. There must be some that there's some grumbling about it.
Oh, sure. There's always, and sometimes it's the grumbling is more during exam weeks or other times during the year. It's a good idea to go a lot in the first part of the semester, so you've got a few.
Okay, I was wondering if you have to do 2 out of 3 every week, or if you can just bank them all up.
You could go to 2/3 of them and then quit. But
all right. Got it.
But that's not all. I mean, we also have small groups on campus that students are involved in, so that they're processing faith together in small groups. Those small groups are often affinity-based, so that maybe the students like to play tennis, and so they put together a tennis small group, and they have a Bible study and play tennis, that kind of thing. Yeah. And then there are student ministries. All of our students are expected to get involved in ministering to people in some way. It could be a lot of our students are involved in things like combating human trafficking, and some are involved with the homeless ministries in the area, like the Union Gospel Mission. They're all kind of prison visitation. They do all kinds of things that allow them to share with other people their faith and get involved in people's lives.
That's the next thing that I wanted to ask about. To what extent you have a missionary outreach component to student life? Because one of the things that, as an outsider, I might worry about is that the religious-based university can become too insular. That the students come to this place, they have the mandatory chapel service, they have restrictions on drinking, live on campus, all these different things. So they don't experience the outside world, and so some ways they might be too sheltered. Do you have a sense of that? Are you worried about that, or how do you combat that if you think it is a problem?
I don't think it's a problem here. Our students, we don't ship them off to Mars. They live here in the middle of the Nun Zone. They work part-time jobs out in the society. They go they go to restaurants and the movies and all kinds of things. If people have the idea that Northwest is some sort of cloistered community, kind of like the picture that people have the Amish, or it's just not that way. Our religious movement is very involved. we participate widely in the culture, so our students are constantly being exposed to non-Christians off campus. And here on campus we have this very warm Christian community, and it's a beautiful thing. Our students love it; they treasure it. That's the reason they come here, is this phenomenal circle of friends that they're surrounded by. But it's not a place to come hide from the world, and we don't take it easy on them in terms of exposing them to questions and walking through them with them. So, our debate team, for example, it was outstanding last year, and they won tournaments all over the region. And they don't go debate Christian schools. They go to Willamette and Seattle University and the University of Puget Sound. And, it's funny, last year we had a tournament, I think it was at University of Puget Sound, and the top 4 speakers were all Northwest University students.
Wow.
We're the only Christian school in the debate. Mm-hmm. Same thing happened at Willamette. We every year we host the Chinese National Debate Team. The Irish National Debate Team comes pretty regularly. We constantly have the team. One of the teams from Harvard will come out. Yale came out last year. We debate against, and we've gone to Oxford very often and debated an international competition there at Oxford and Cambridge. I mean, our students are debating the issues of the time, and they don't know which side they're going to have to argue, whether they're going to argue a conservative side or a liberal side or secular side or religious side. They don't know that until they step into the room, and they've got to be ready to argue both sides of the case. And it really doesn't matter which side they're arguing. They win. They win quite frequently. So we do show debates over at Microsoft, and those have been very well received. Every year we do something over there, do a show debate with whoever the guest is, whether it's Harvard or China or
whoever.
Cool. So same thing with our intercollegiate athletics. We compete in the NAIA. Which is a small college equivalent of the NCAA. And our conference has the Oregon Tech University, Eastern Oregon University, Evergreen State College of Washington. So we're playing sports with you know, teams from secular universities, and we compete very well. We've been, our men's basketball has been in the national tournament 3 years in a row.
Yes, I know. You guys are very proud. And your nickname, you are the Eagles, correct?
We are the Eagles.
Okay, and go Eagles.
Our women won the conference championship the regular season last year in soccer. Mm-hmm. So, we're not shielding our students from worldly influence. We're just being a Christian community, and what's wrong with that? Mm-hmm.
Okay. I want to turn next to the faculty, and that is a very important aspect of any university administration. The people that you choose are going to have a great deal of impact on the students. What is your strategy for finding well-trained faculty? Do you require a statement of faith by them?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, faculty here are required to sign the statement of faith of the university.
And what's the gist of that? You don't have to read it verbatim.
It's pretty much a historic Orthodox evangelical statement of faith. It's colored by our Pentecostalism for sure, but we're not buttonholing people all the time on everything they say. There's academic freedom here. But it's bounded like everywhere. There's no such thing as perfect academic freedom anywhere. I know at Columbia, when I was at Columbia, if I'd have taken certain positions, I would have been vilified pretty roughly. Same thing at Princeton Theological Seminary. I remember it was a lot worse at Princeton Theological than it was at Columbia, where I was absolutely pilloried for defending evangelical perspectives on one thing or another, or I remember when somebody once came to me and said, "It makes me sick that you're going to be a missionary in Central America and take your American ideas and foist them on those people." And,
yeah.
Well, gee, why don't you ask me about it before you condemn me? What is it you think I think?
Yeah, so much for ecumenism there, I guess.
Well, you know, the thing is, there are orthodoxies everywhere.
Right. And that's true.
One of my professors said to me the other day, I feel a lot more academic freedom here than I do at the University of Washington, because they adjunct. They teach at both places, and there's all kinds of different expressions in academia, and that's what makes our American system so incredible, is the amazing diversity of institutions that we have, whether it's a Catholic university or a Jewish university or an evangelical one or a completely secular one, whether it's community college or research university or a liberal arts college or and it goes on and on. Our technical institute, we have an amazingly diverse system, and I think that allows people to live vigorously in what they think in their search for truth and knowledge.
In terms of the statement of faith that you require your faculty to sign, it must limit the pool of candidates that you can draw from in attracting faculty here. So where do you find the best and brightest faculty to bring here? And has that been a challenge for you over time? And what ways are you trying to deal with that?
Well, that's part of the beauty of being a university as opposed to a college. If you're a college, you've got one academic dean who is looking for faculty, perhaps with the help of department heads and that kind of things. They're looking for faculty across a wide variety of fields that person may not have a whole lot of expertise in. When you have a university and each one of the schools and colleges has its own dean who's a specialist in the subject area of that college, you have more people doing the search. Mm-hmm. So, it's the same as networking in any field. We meet people in scholarly associations. Our people are involved in publishing and research and scholarly societies. And then there's the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, which is sort of the umbrella organization for our kind of school. And, they have employment pages where people are looking for jobs. The Assemblies of God also keeps a database of its own members who are academicians and want teaching positions. But really, it's mostly about the relationships that we develop. I mean, we've got people here that are unbelievable. I mean, the last person I hired has a PhD from Indiana University, a JD and LLM from Cornell University Law School, has had tenure at three universities, had an incredible career, three Fulbright awards, is coming to us now from having taught several years at the Salahuddin University in Iraqi Kurdistan, teaching law and gender at their law school. He's going to come here to teach politics next year, and amazing publication record and a real activist. I mean, a remarkable person and a really serious Christian at the same time. We've got people here that secular universities would be envious. I mean, it would be envying us. You know, Hispanics with PhDs in science, or you know, it's a we don't have as much faculty diversity as we like, but the kind of school we are draws a certain kind of scholar. And
yeah, I can, and I think this combats one of the stereotypes that's out there in the secular academy, that most people who go into the academy are a secular orientation and would shun a religious school. But there are a number of people, and I've met them through graduate school, through graduate students that I have trained, and through other faculty, that would, you know, would look to a place like this and say, you know, this is just like students are looking for a home, for a Christian community home. The faculty do too, and they might be willing to make a trade-off between a, you know, secular institution somewhere and a Christian community home that they can feel welcome at.
Oh, absolutely. And sometimes it's towards the end of their careers that they'll want to come and spend 5 or 10 years teaching in a Christian university. And sometimes it's at the beginning of their careers, and it's hard to get a job anywhere, and they're willing to come and gain tenure here and perhaps look for a job at a larger place at a later part in their career. But I mean, there are all kinds of motivations to come to a school like Northwest. But I think the thing, the real payoff for most of us is the really warm community that we have here and the sense of common purpose.
In terms of the faculty, there's always a pressure between publishing and teaching. And how does Northwest University manage that? I mean, one of the things is you are a private university, so you know the parents and the students are going to have to pick up the tab here, and they're going to expect a lot of attention from the faculty as compared to, say, a state research institution such as the University of Washington, where we are expected to publish. There is emphasis on teaching, of course, but it's not as big as many students would like it to be or many parents would like it to be. So where does Northwest University come down on this publishing versus teaching ratio?
There's no question about it. We are a teaching institution. We are not a tier one or two research university. We're not any tier research university yet, but that doesn't mean that our people aren't involved in research. Sometimes it's that they'll be involved with someone at the University of Washington and research that's being done there because there's some, you know, federal funding for research or that kind of thing. It's some in, you know, in the more liberal arts field, research is a labor of love. Of course, it always is in any field, but you don't always have funding for that kind of research the way you would for you know, scientific and technical research, but medical research and that kind of thing. But our people have done well. I mean, last year, the last 2 years in a row, you know, the Hutchison Cancer, the Fred Hutchison Cancer Institute here in Seattle has a big internship program every year to draw research interns in. And I was there last year to see our students' entry in the research poster competition. And I mean, I was amazed to see the students that were there. They were from Swarthmore and Haverford and Carleton, and Penn State University, University of North Carolina, New Mexico State, several of the top research universities in the country, and top liberal arts colleges. I mean, these students were elite. And then our student from Northwest among them. Well, the last 2 years in a row, our student has won the research poster award over all those other students.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
And one of them is starting a master's program in epidemiology at Oxford next year, and the other one's in medical school. But one of our students got in the University of Washington Med School this year, which was a big deal
yeah.
for us. So, you know, we're exposing our students to research and getting them opportunities to have research during their undergraduate life. Of course, in our doctoral program in psychology, all of those students are doing dissertation grade research, and so there's research being done by people all over, because you've got to do a certain amount of it to get tenure. But it isn't the publish or perish here. It's publish to flourish. You publish here because of your own sense of scholarly pride that you are a scholar and that you this is what you trained to do, and out of your own sense of conscience, you want to do research. You want to continue publishing. And of course, I continue to write and publish myself.
I think that's one of the advantages too of a smaller university like this. There's more of a a smaller faculty to student ratio where students can become involved with the work of faculty members and leverage that. You know, at bigger research universities, that's usually covered by graduate students. So undergraduates don't really get a chance to work one-on-one or within small groups with a faculty member on some research project that they're interested in or that the faculty member is interested in, unless at like a University of Washington or University of Michigan, the undergraduate student is very aggressive in pressing their interest. But here it seems that you can cultivate that so much easier.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, I've been in really large classes in other universities, like at Columbia, I had some really big classes. And when I was at the University of North Alabama, I had some really large classes. I understand a couple of years ago, University of Washington had, I saw it in the papers, had 800 students in their freshman biology class.
Man, they got Kane Hall. That's big, yeah.
You know, I guarantee you our biology students can outdo them. You know, we just don't have classes that size. A lot of our classes are 10 or 15 or even 20, but never bigger than 50, even for, you know, the biggest freshman orientation class wouldn't be bigger than that. And most classes are much, much smaller. So our students know that the faculty member knows their name. Their door is open to them. The faculty member cares about them as people. And, you know, they'll go to them not just for questions about the subject matter of the course, but go and ask them about life questions. And so, you know, we think that having the opportunity for the professor, you know, I'd say there's none of our professors who aren't qualified to teach at any university in the country. They're well-trained people, really, really bright. But to have that professor who knows your name and cares about you, that's not bad for the educational process.
Yeah. No, that is absolutely true. But that then raises another issue of that. If you have that smaller ratio of students to faculty, it's not going to be as efficient as teaching 800 students with one faculty member. So that price of college tuition always comes up. And there's been a great deal of criticism in the news. It comes up every year, usually going into the school year, that, oh my gosh, college tuition prices are going up so rapidly. What are we getting for this? How does Northwest University manage that? And how do you compete with some of the, you know, state-subsidized schools like Western Washington, University of Washington, or Central?
Well, it's getting easier every year to compete with them. Because the state university tuitions are going up, up, up as the state subsidies go down, down, down. So, you know, I won't accept that our 50 students in our biggest class being 50 is less efficient than the UW class with 800. On the whole, for the institution, we're pretty efficient. Our students graduate. Let me speak about private colleges in general. The students at private colleges graduate in higher percentages within 4 to 5 years than they do at state universities. So it's not less efficient for the student, and we don't tend to have as much administrative harness for the academic horse as those kind of schools do. So we operate leaner in other ways in order to put their focus on the attention that the student's getting in the class. So, you know, if I, let's say if I have 100 students in the class at a secular university, but in order to do it, I have to hire an extra administrator, you know, it equals out, doesn't it? I mean, so it isn't inefficient, and we make it work. As a matter of fact, I think you look at the finances of private colleges around the country, it's pretty inspiring what they get done on the money that they have to work with.
Mm-hmm. I will testify to that Northwest University is remarkably efficient in what it does, because one of the faculty members here, Kevin Cooney, who's appeared on this podcast in the past, and I have worked on a joint student program that gets University of Washington and Northwest students together, and it was originally targeted to have it at University of Washington, but it was going to take months to get the project off the ground. And when I contacted Kevin, I said, Kevin, can we run this program on Northwest University? He said, okay. And then within 24 hours, he's like, boom, we got it set up. And so you guys are efficient. To that, I will testify. But there is that issue that you don't receive the state subsidies. Students get scholarships and fellowships, obviously, to come here. But how much pressure do you feel to keep the tuition cost low? And how do you manage with students who might not be able to quite make that payment?
Well, if we don't keep the tuition costs low, we'll be out of business. You know, so there's plenty of motivation to keep it low. We are, I think, the second cheapest comprehensive university in the state among privates. And so we keep our tuition, our stated tuition price, low. And also, we discount that price heavily to help students come. So the average net price here at Northwest might be about $14,000 a year in tuition per student, and that's not a whole lot more than the University of Washington. And if you take everything into account, it might be a better deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it depends on how much scholarship.
In terms of what you get in faculty, you know, ratio, faculty-student ratios, in terms of getting them involved in these programs at Fred Hutchinson and all those, that's it is amazing value.
Well, it's interesting. UW is our number two competitor most years at looking at cross apps, and we do a pretty good job of yielding those students who would apply at both places. So. We compete pretty well.
We're running close on the end of our time here, and I just want to finish up with a general question for you. You've been in this position for 6 years, and you've had the opportunity to reflect on trends in the general academic setting, within the religious academic setting. How are there any trends that you see that are of concern for you? And then also another general question to throw out there, where does Northwest go from here? What future plans does your university have to meet the changing educational environment?
Well, we have a very aggressive plan to address the future. As I said, I was an old distance education guy before I came here. And when I came here, we were 75% traditional students and 25% non-traditional. By traditional, I mean you're 18 to 22-year-old college freshman living on campus or slightly off campus and attending classes on the main campus during the daytime, right? Non-traditional students would be your adult ed, degree completion students in the evening, your graduate students, the students off in extension sites and online, right? So we were 75% traditional when I came. We are now 51% non-traditional, and my intention is to flip it completely so that in the future we'll be 75% non-traditional.
And that's a big change just in 6 years.
Oh, yeah, that's a huge change. Yeah, we're moving pretty quick. I see the day in the future. We're at 1,900 students next fall. I see the day coming when we will be 1,200 undergraduate students on campus. We're at 950 now. We can handle 1,200 on the campus, and the city's got us capped at 1,200. They won't let us grow past
that. Okay, there's space issues.
Yeah. So we have more space than we have 56 acres here. We got plenty of space, but the city just, it's a residential neighborhood, and that's how many students they want. So we'll grow to 1,200 here on campus. And then we'll have three times that many off campus in our extension sites and online and in adult and graduate programs. So that's our strategy. And by building the pie bigger that way, it will help us to be able to invest more in making that traditional program on campus more and more elite. My strategy is called more elite and less exclusive. Mm-hmm. The on-campus program has to become more elite in its academic quality and the quality of facilities and the quality of the academic quality of the students who come for that program. There will come a time when we'll have to be more academically selective than we are. We're already somewhat selective, but we'll become even more selective as the college grows. And the more prestige the bricks and mortar component of our business has, the more prestige it shares with our other programs. And, you know, already I think most people would rather have an online degree from the University of Washington than from the University of Phoenix, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think the more we build our on-campus brand, the more cachet that our non-traditional programs will have. So it all kind of works together.
Seems to be a virtuous cycle. Very good.
Thank you.
Well, Joe Castleberry, president of Northwest University, want to thank you for being on the program today. And for all those listeners that are interested in Northwest University, please check out our website. We will link to their website as well as the books by Joe Castleberry. So, Joe, once again, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.